So our first speaker is Michael Praskas. He's going to be talking about the role of wetland soil short courses in postgraduate education with training.
Okay, John, thanks a lot. Can you all hear me? Okay, good. I'm going to start with a brief introduction and answer the question, what is a short course? Well, as the name suggests, it's a course that lasts for 1 to 5 days, but it's designed to give intense training on a narrowly focused topic. We're trying to train professionals, people that have graduated and are on the job working, some skill, and that skill results from a change in regulations. So we respond to these short courses to changes in regulations and try to give people the skills they need to do their job better. At NC State, we teach a number of short courses. They're short shown here, wetlands protection, wetland delineation, erosion control, on-site wastewater treatment, land application of wastes, nutrient management, among others. But all of these courses, I think, have one thing in common, and that is they were begun as a result of some regulation where students needed additional training. I want to talk about talk about my background and my co-authors, Dave Linbo. We've taught short courses for about 15 years, actually over 15 years at NC State. We both teach the NC State course, and I also assist the USDA with their hydric soils training and taught contract courses for the Corps of Engineers and some other agencies. The course we teach at NC State is a hydric soils class. It's in two parts, basic processes and then advanced techniques. This is a 4-day class. I also am a teacher for the USDA's advanced hydric soils for soil scientists. That is also essentially a 4-day class. Now, short courses can be taught nationwide. This illustrates where we've taught the USDA class, NC States, and some contract teaching. You can see that the USDA classes have been taught in the West, Midwest and Southeast, as well as the Northeast. We've concentrated in Wisconsin a few times, more than the others, because they invited us back a number of times. I'm from Wisconsin as well, but that had nothing to do with it. So we did try to make a pretty good coverage of the nation. Now, for NC State, we have tended to focus strictly in the Southeast, since most of our teaching is in North Carolina, as you might expect. We have included Georgia in some classes to see if we could get a difference in soils. We picked Savannah, in that case, to hopefully attract more students as well. Didn't work too well. For contracts, shown in green, we also will contract to teach a short course for a federal agency if they desire. We've done this in Virginia and in Mississippi for the Corps of Engineers as well as NOAA. In all cases, we've basically taught the same material unless something has dictated a slight variation. Let's turn to wetlands. To understand what we teach and why we teach, I have to go over briefly the wetland regulation situation in this country. As most of you know, wetlands are protected by both state and federal laws. Any project that requires filling a wetland needs a permit. This might involve building a home, a parking lot, subdivision, whatever. If you're going to fill in a wetland, you need to get a permit from the Corps of Engineers to do so. Now, for that permit application, the boundaries of the jurisdictional wetland in the area must be drawn on a map. And this is where the soil scientist comes in. They will actually go out and prepare that map for a permit application. Now, in drawing the wetland boundaries, the regulations require that we look for 3 parameters. Now, some people object to the word parameter in this case, but this is the official term for these 3 things. A site to be a jurisdictional wetland has to have wetland hydrology, hydrophytic plants, and hydric soils. And our job as soil scientists is, of course, to identify the hydric soils in particular. Now, it may surprise you, but this is the definition of hydric soils that is part of the wetland regulation program. It requires that hydric soils are those that formed under conditions of saturation, flooding, or ponding that lasted long enough during the growing season to develop anaerobic conditions in the upper part. The thing I want you to note is that The most important part of this definition is shown in red to develop the anaerobic conditions in the upper part. In other words, hydric soils are defined on the basis of soil chemistry just as much as on saturation in this country. So the soil scientist dealing or trying to identify hydric soils has to go out and look for signs or what we call field indicators that only form in anaerobic or reduced soils. These indicators you'll be familiar with, at least in part. They have unique color patterns, the red and the gray colors we commonly associate with wetlands, and can also be carbon-rich layers. Now that's my introduction. Let me turn now to the objectives of the talk. I want to do four things in the remaining time. First, talk about student characteristics. Who takes these short courses? Why? I want to discuss the course setup. Then talk about the business aspects. And then end with a discussion of pros and cons. Well, why do students take a short course? And again, these are largely professionals working on the job. Well, it's to gain new knowledge and specifically to gain new skills for their current job. What we teach them in 4 days, they want to use the next week to earn money. Okay? And that pretty much sets the stage for what you have to teach. In addition, if they have a certificate or a license, again, soil science is licensed in some states in the United States, North Carolina is one, you will need continuing education credits to keep your license or your certificate, and that can be fulfilled in a short course. Lastly, to fulfill graduate degree requirements. For our distance learning program, two field courses are required. This could be one. We've had graduate students who are doing research on hydric soils, and they need additional training, like how to identify one. And we also have had some professors come in who want to teach a hydric soils course, or at least a wetlands course, to learn more about it. Now, most of our training in North Carolina, most of our training through the NC State short course is done in North Carolina, roughly where that star is. But if you want to teach a short course using the same material, more or less the same material, over a long period of time, you have to attract a nationwide audience. If you stick in-state, you're going to run through your pool of available students pretty darn fast. So the red dots show the states where we have attracted students over the last 15 years. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, we taught a short course in North Carolina, and we had one student from Utah, Washington State, and California, as well as many of the other states in the Eastern U.S. But if you try to attract a national audience, even though you teach in one location, you can be successful if people in all these areas of the country need that training. Now, you'll notice that I haven't been able to attract anybody from Kansas and Nebraska, and that's simply because a mistake on my part. You have to advertise the course, and the mailing list that we use you had to pay a little more for Kansas and Nebraska, and I just realized that, never did, so we never advertised there, and obviously nobody from there showed up. Now, another thing about a short course that differs from regular university training is that you're tied to the business cycle. Your students, as I said, are professionals. They work for consulting companies or regulatory agencies. When you're dealing with hydric soils, you're also dealing with the real estate industry. Again, people are building things. And so when the real estate industry is booming, you're going to have a lot of students. But when the real estate industry goes bust, you're going to cut your student numbers at least in half and maybe more. So, when you teach a short course, you do have to advertise, and you will be impacted by the business cycle. Recessions will be felt. So let's talk about the makeup of our class. This is student numbers on the y-axis and years on the x-axis, starting in 2008, or just after the real estate bubble burst. You can see that in general we're teaching about 35 to 40 students per year, and we teach two classes per year, so each class is half this, roughly 18, 19 students, something like that. To give you some feel for the business cycle, prior to the real estate bubble bursting, we would teach 40 students in a single class. So there is a marked impact from the economy itself. Most of our students are consultants, as shown by the blue line. You can see that the numbers were decreasing through 2009, but have fortunately shown a steady increase. This means more jobs for soil scientists, I hope. State workers have also been part of our student body, and you can see that there's been a steady decline. I don't have any statistics on this, but it just seems that it has been declining since 2009. Again, this is a result of the recession, I think. States are laying people off. North Carolina has laid off a number of people, 3,000, I think, at the last count. And some of those must include wetland delineators. Surprisingly, the federal workers are even part of our audience. Not many students, but we do attract some. And their numbers seem to be going up. And I think this is due to federal agencies not having education money to train their own people as much as they'd like. So some of the students are coming, paying their own bill, or at least getting some money from their agency to take our short course. So, but the main message is that consultants working on the job are going to be the main audience, at least for this class. Now, what's their background? Who's taken this class? Well, we attract biologists, engineers, foresters, and soil scientists. For federal regulators, we train people from the Corps of Engineers primarily, occasionally from the EPA. State employees and state regulators include departments of transportation, universities from around the country, sanitarians, geological survey, fish and wildlife service, and so on. So all of these people are looking for training in hydric soils. Here is a breakdown, or my estimate of percentages, of the students by major. You can see that biologists make up over half your student body, at least for us. Now, you have to know your audience to teach to them, and this requires you then to teach soil science to biologists. And since they make up the majority of the class, we focus most of our lectures on what a biologist needs to know. It is true that soil scientists and environmental scientists make up about 20% each. They're good students. Engineers make up about 10% in this country. I think it's because these are surveyors, and surveying may be having some, job pressures as well, and they're always looking to find another skill that they can use to make some money. But the take-home message is a course like this is going to be taught primarily to biologists. What's the course setup? Our wetlands short courses, as I said, last 4 days. Mornings are saved for lectures, and then the afternoons we go out into the field. The lectures are based on PowerPoint presentations, and homework is assigned. Homework is critical in this case because you're going to have to have them work after hours to gain these skills that you hope they're learning. Here are the lecture topics for our typical four-day class. We have to go over soil morphology, how to read colors, texture, do profile descriptions, and so on, because, again, some of these people come in with either no training or are pretty rusty. To understand wetlands and wetland processes, you have to review soil chemistry, redoxymorphic features. We also go over hydrology basics, what water tables are, how groundwater moves, where in the landscape wetlands occur. We try to do this for different landscapes around the country. Monitoring hydrology is also becoming increasingly important. For problem hydric soils that don't have the proper color patterns, you will have to prove they're hydric using measurements. This is measurements of water table levels, measurements of redox potential, and things of that nature. And so we have to go over monitoring as well. Day 3 are techniques for monitoring reduction. This would include redox potentials, iris tubes, and use of dyes. And the hydric soil technical standard is basically the USDA's requirements for how a hydric soil can be identified using measurements of water table levels and anaerobic conditions. And we go over that as well. The last day is basically saved for fun, in my opinion. We go over hydrologic modeling very briefly and then talk about how the results can be used. And we don't make the students practice modeling. We just want them exposed to it and make sure they understand that we feel models are valuable. They turn out good information we are going to have to use increasingly as time goes by. But some people are just turned off to models. They say, okay, that's a model. I don't care. I don't like it. You know, it gives me bogus information. Well, that's baloney. And you're going to have to use modeling results or certainly not turn away from when they're presented to you. And so then we talk about how these models can be used to give us and how hydrology relates to soil color. Lastly, I don't want to talk about relic colors, but the students have asked me to. I think it's a guessing game in most part, but I leave them with that impression as well. Since you're dealing with, you have a short time period, you don't know what the background of these students are. When you do your lectures, they have to be simple and straightforward. I said we have to talk about redox chemistry, and this is what we do. Actually, the little cartoon is strictly out of a famous publication, The Chemistry of Wetland Soils by F.N. Punnamparuma. He didn't use the cartoon, but basically what it portrays is what he means. So what's oxidation in an oxidation-reduction reaction? Well, it produces electrons when two things are present. I showed this earlier if you were at my earlier talk. Organic matter is the source of electrons. Bacterium releases them. And the electrons are released for redox reactions when the bacteria eats the apple and out its rear end comes an electron and a proton. Now, though it may seem silly, this is in fact what happens. Now, I can't guarantee it comes out the rear end. But beyond that, this is pretty factual, okay? So the organic matter is needed as a source of electrons to start these reactions. Reduction takes the electron and the proton from the oxidation and then uses it to add to an electron donor to reduce some of the elements in soil. In this case, we're reducing nitrate to nitrogen gas, and that's the reduction phase. This is denitrification. Anyway, cartoons like this are used throughout our class to try to illustrate the major points. They're factual and hopefully are simplified enough to make people understand how they relate to field conditions. You have to do the same thing with hydrology. Surprisingly, very few people seem to be trained in hydrology nowadays. Many people do not know the difference between wells and piezometers, or they don't know what a water table is. Okay, so we go over that, again, with PowerPoint, animation, just trying to make the points, and hopefully at the end of 4 days, they've got the idea. They're very sharp. They just don't have the background information that typical soil scientists like us were probably trained in. Well, you see some happy students here. We provide lunch. I can guarantee you, an hour or two in my lecture before this, they weren't smiling like that. But we feed them. It's an additional cost, but at least we keep the group together and can control when we get them to the field. The field skills are probably the most important part, but as I said, without lecture training, you cannot get these people ready for the field. The most important skill, in my opinion, that someone needs to know in order to identify hydric soils is how to complete a soil profile description. If you can't do this, you will not identify hydric soils accurately. Period. So we spend 4 days just trying to get students up to speed on doing profile descriptions. Some people believe you ought to simplify identifying field indicators. I disagree. What we need to do is make sure everyone knows how to do a profile description. Second thing is the skill they come to us for is learning how to identify hydric soil field indicators. And hopefully we do a pretty good job with that after 4 days. Problem soils will require monitoring, or finding problem hydric soils will require that you monitor the site. And so we have to have them install equipment as well as interpret the monitoring data. Our students in the field will work in groups, usually four or less. We spread them out, and they do their work that way. As I said, describing a profile description is most important. Hopefully, in a group of four, there's enough skill there to allow them to do the job. At a minimum, I want them to be able to complete this sheet by the end of the class. You can see they have to identify soil horizons, and it's not too critical that they identify them accurately, but you have to be able to describe the individual soil layers, give the depths, texture, matrix color, the presence of redoxymorphic features, any organic coatings, any reaction to the dye, and so on. This is what I want at the end of the class. And in addition, once we have this in hand, then we are ready to identify the hydric soil field indicators. We critique the students in describing their soils. Go group to group. I read off the descriptions. We point out any errors. This isn't done to embarrass anybody, but you better be looking at all the sheets because some people really still have no clue, particularly on that first day. Most people don't know how to install wells and piezometers, and we follow the Corps of Engineers procedure in this and actually bring equipment to the field. Every group has to install the equipment to the specifications of the Corps before they get out of this class. In addition, we have to install monitoring equipment for anaerobic conditions, redox potentials, iris tubes, and the use of dipyridyl dye are all covered. Now, let's turn to hydric soil field indicators. This is what they come to learn from us. Now, the USDA field indicators are what we specialize in. We've done that for 15 years, even though the other indicators have been around. Now it's come full circle, and these are the only field indicators, to my knowledge, used to identify hydric soils in the United States. These field indicators are features that form in anaerobic and reduced soils. They've been identified for virtually any hydric soil in the United States, so we think they are useful nationwide. They're composed of carbon, iron, manganese, and sulfur, or related to the reduction of those elements, or they form by a loss of iron oxides. And they're used for on-site verification. Okay? You have to know what these indicators are and how to identify them if you're going to identify hydric soils. The indicators that we teach are listed in this publication that is updated every 3 or 4 years. It's Field Indicators of Hydric Soils in the United States. This is the 2010 is the latest version. Over 40 field indicators have been identified across the United States. We cannot cover all of them, obviously. In fact, we only cover probably 10. But if you know how to identify 10 from a profile description, you can handle the rest of the 40, okay, in my opinion. Now, the field indicators are just layers of soil whose thickness, depth, color characteristics, and abundance, in contrast to rhodoxymorphic features, have been rigidly defined. You've got to be careful with these things. If the depth says something has to occur within 10 inches or 25 centimeters, and it occurs at 26 centimeters, or excuse me, it occurs at 25 centimeters or less, it may not make the indicator. It may not be a hydric soil. This is just one example, and you can see, I hope, from it why a profile description is needed. This is the depleted matrix, indicator F3. It's the most common field indicator in the United States. It's defined as a layer of at least 15 centimeters thick with a depleted matrix, which means it has 60% or more chromatureless in the matrix, and this layer starts within 25 centimeters of the surface. In most cases, you will need some redox concentrations or reddish models as well. But if you meet this definition, you have a hydric soil anywhere in the United States. No ifs, ands, or buts. Don't worry about hydrology. Don't worry about plants. You've got a hydric soil. It may not be a wetland, but it is a hydric soil. Now, starting to run out of time. The business aspects have to be discussed, because if you want to teach a course for 15 years, you're going to have to operate it like a small business, okay? Watch income, watch expenses, and make a profit. You should make money on this class, or at least you have to break even. Nobody's going to bail you out if you don't make money. At NC State, we're on our own. If the course loses money, then the instructors make it up, okay, out of their own pocket. So far, we haven't lost any money. But you have to understand, you've got to start looking at this like a business. If that bothers you, then this is not the kind of stuff for you. I'm not a businessman, but it seems to me that a simple equation pretty much allows you to estimate whether you ought to do this or not. Income minus expenses has got to equal your profit, and that profit's got to be above zero. Your income will be student fees, and so generally you're going to be charging for a four-day class something like $500 to $1,000. Okay, if it's over $1,000, students may drop out because other courses are cheaper. If it's under $500, I'm not sure you're going to be able to make your expenses. Okay, you'll lose money. Major expenses will be advertising, room rental, student materials, transportation, meals, and administration. Here are the major expenses with some numbers for a single four-day class. Advertising is your most expensive cost, again, if you're trying to attract a national audience. Student materials come next. These are the binders with the lecture materials, homework, and that sort of thing. Meals and administration and room rental are about $700 to $800. Administration is just the cost for somebody to collect the money and pay the bills. Transportation is provided by the university. Actually, we pay for it, but it comes through the university for a total of about $7,000 to teach a four-day class. We have to spend some time talking about marketing if you want to do this. Marketing is critical. People will not come to your class if they don't know it's being taught. Now, you can reach students or potential students by word of mouth, direct mailings, online postings, websites, and email. I have not had much luck with email. But direct mailings and online postings are what seem to work best for us. Direct mailings. The direct mailings for a wetlands class is fairly simple. We have access to a large mailing list, and we mail out brochures. If you're considering this for something other than wetlands, make sure that you have a large mailing list available to you to use. Also remember, most brochures are going to end up in a garbage can. Okay, it takes about 150 brochures mailed out to attract a single student. Now, that may sound like a lot, but for the entire cost of mailing this stuff, if we get one student, one extra student, it pays for itself. Okay? So it's a cost that's critical. If you don't do it, you're going to pay the price in lack of enrollment. The Society of Wetland Scientists has the rents a mailing list for about 3,000 with about 3,000 names, and it's costing about $1,000. Printing and mailing. Printing is cheap. Mailing is done for us through a mailing house. We just send them the brochures and the mailing list, and they mail everything out. There's no licking of the stamps or anything like that. Postage will be your major cost. Now, benefits of short courses. Well, I think it allows working professionals to keep up to date. They will need this, particularly when regulations change. You may be against regulations, but when they change, it means more jobs for soil scientists, at least for teachers. So I'm, you know, keep an open mind. The students can acquire a new skill quickly. They don't become proficient by any means, but we get them going. We get them started. They will have to continue practicing. We get them working at it. They will be able to earn continuing education credits, and they also make professional contacts. Instructors also benefit. They learn what's needed in the outside world, what the students need to know. You might get some ideas for research as well, and that can even be incorporated in the class. If the course makes money, the instructors can collect the profit, and so it can be financially rewarding. And some of our students come back and ask us to hire us as consultants for particularly problem situations. So I think there's plenty of benefits. There are some problems, too. I have to admit the courses are too short for full skill development. The students will we get them started, but they will have to keep practicing to become proficient. Some people believe that we should not train biologists to do soil science work. I disagree with that. These biologists are going to be trained in soil science, whether I do it or not. The question that we should ask is, should a soil scientist be training biologists in soil science? And I'd say, yeah, we should. Weather becomes a factor. We've been closed down by hurricanes, rain, heat, flooding of sites. But basically nothing should stop us. Well, to wrap up, short courses are the major way professionals stay current in their field. They should be narrowly focused and, in my opinion, offered to a national audience if you want to teach the same material again and again and again. If you stick in-state, you're going to run through your student body in a couple of years. The instructor should be an authority on the subject. Okay, if this is related to regulations at all, the instructor should be part of a regulatory group that sets the regulations so he knows all the background information. And I have to emphasize, courses should be managed to make money. If you want to lose money and you're careless, now this is a good way to do it, all right? But you're going to have to pay the price. At any rate, I've taught for 15 years. I find them very rewarding, a lot of fun, and hope I can continue for the next 15 years. So if you have any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer them. Thank you. Thank you. Yes. Well, the instructors are paid from the profit. Okay? Expense. Income minus expense equal profit. So we just take the profit. There's nothing else left. Funny you should ask about money. You must work for a university, okay? Anything else? Yeah. Yes, the question is, does this count for accreditation or for a degree? It certainly counts for our distance learning master's degree. Our distance learning students are required to take a field class. They will get one credit for this, so they can earn college credit for it. In terms of accreditation, I'm not sure exactly what you mean because we don't normally use that term, but it does count to maintain your license. So you'll have to if you have a license, you need a certain number of continuing education credits or training every year, and this will count toward that. Mm-hmm. Right, we would call it a licensed soil scientist, or you'd have ARCPEC certification, I guess. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes, it does. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but the way we, the question is, how does the instructor avoid conflict of interest with collecting money from the student and then also charging the student for tuition? When the student is taking this for a credit, we don't charge them the fee. All right, then they have to pay for that credit as tuition to the university. Okay, so it turns out to be a pretty good deal. We're soaking the students for about $15,000 to get a distance learning degree if they're from North Carolina. So we don't want to take any more from them. Yeah. Right. Yeah, the question is, would we accept international students? I think is that the question. Yes, international students. Anybody who pays the fee is entitled to come. If they pay, they get in. Okay. We've never had anybody from outside the United States. We had one student from Africa once, but we had to cancel the class. Since then, we haven't had anybody else. We did get one USDA worker from Puerto Rico, but that's the closest. I have not advertised overseas, so they may not know about it. And because it deals with federal regulations, I've always felt that there wouldn't be many students in foreign countries who wanted to take it. I think it's a great idea and something I'll keep in mind. All of a sudden I see the dollar signs and a whole new audience is opening up. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.